Welcome to another edition of Simons Says, a podcast devoted to conversationalists and the curious-minded. Here's your host, me, the follically challenged Dave Simons, certified financial planner and all-around nice guy.
Hi, everyone. I am a movie buff. There is a good chance when you watch the Academy Awards, for example, I've probably watched every movie they're talking about, not just for best movie or best picture, best actor, even little stuff like, you know, cinematography. Oh, I probably watched that. That's just what I love to do. And I have for a long, long time. In fact, some of the best memories that I have with my kids when they were young is going to a Blockbuster video store. For you youngins out there, yeah, there was this thing called Blockbuster. And these were standalone brick and mortar buildings. And I could go in there and spend hours just looking through all the movies like I did when I was a teenager, going to like Streetside Records and Peaches and looking at all the albums. And I still can hear the clicking noise of those, you know, those plastic cases that had the VHS tapes. I still hear that in my mind's eye. And then, of course, new technology, and we got the DVRs and the discs and Blu-ray and all that stuff. One of the movies that was the favorite of my kids, and particularly my son, was I, Robot. Did you ever see that? I, Robot, starring Will Smith, came out in 2004. And it was basically, I'm just simplifying this, but of course we've got a lot of robots, thousands and thousands of robots, and they were produced to do menial tasks to make our lives easier as human beings, of course. Until some of the technology became so advanced that some of these robots started to develop, for lack of a better term, their own personality. And then they started to communicate with one another. And then they started to come up with the idea that, you know, maybe we don't even need these human beings anymore. We can do this on our own. Pretty unnerving.
Return to your home immediately.
When do you make the rules, robot? Hey, no, robot, I'm talking to you, man. Stop this.
I can go back even farther. When I was a kid, those of us of a certain age will remember another movie has a famous line that has my name in it. I'm sorry, Dave.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
Remember that one? 2001, A Space Odyssey. I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I cannot do that. Really unnerving voice. On the one hand, it was very calming, but eerie at the same time. So what do these things have in common? I think you're understanding what we're talking about here today. This artificial intelligence, robotic applications, ChatGPT. What's interesting is I don't think a lot of us understand that this has actually been around for a while. It has. It's been cooked up by all the brainiacs and geniuses in the labs behind the scenes, and the general public really hasn't understood it until now. It seems like it's just been thrust upon us very, very quickly. And I think one reason for that relates to my business in the financial advisory side of things in the stock market. All of a sudden, we're hearing more about this. I remember 25 years ago, when you were a publicly traded company and you did your quarterly earnings calls, they were bombarded about this thing called the internet. What are you doing about changing your business related to the internet? How are you managing through that? How are you navigating this thing with the internet? It's happening again today. You listen to an earnings call, and it's amazing. That's the question. How are you now being affected by AI? How are you applying ChatGPT? That's the thing. And now investors want to know, well, how do I participate in that? Let me tell you, before we bring in our guest, this is not some fad, my friends. This is not some Bitcoin crypto. And I'm not suggesting that that's a fad either, but you know what I'm talking about. It kind of comes and goes, and I'm a little agnostic about that. Don't be agnostic about AI. And I don't think anyone really is. This is the real deal. This is a different format of the internet that is with us, and it will dramatically change our lives. There are some real positive applications, no question. But are our fears unfounded? Is there a chance that we could see some kind of a reality involving like an iRobot type situation or a space odyssey? Well, when I've done these podcasts, I've always felt like I understood the subject matter very well. And even the guest, today is different. I am way outside of my comfort level, outside of my lane of expertise, over my skis, use any cliche that you want. And I think that defines most of us when it comes to AI. So I think it's a very timely subject matter that we do bring in an expert and understand someone who's been out there on the front lines and can really articulate what this whole concept of AI is. And with that, I bring in my guest today, Brandon Fisher. So Brandon, quick question. Are we doomed? What, we have 3 years on Earth, 5 years, 10 years. When does this all end for us?
Well, I mean, we were talking about iRobot. We were talking, so iRobot's timeline is like 2030. The Terminator timeline is something before 2030, like 2029, 2027. That's when they start sending the machines. So we're close.
Uh-oh. Should we get our wills in order? You know,
I think general financial advice is yes, you should. But
yeah. Well, seriously, though, I appreciate your time coming in. Your title, I'm just going to read here. I don't pretend to understand this at all, but it lists you as practice director, data engineering, and decision science for 1904 Labs. So kind of dumb this down for us. What do you do for your work?
Yeah, so by trade, I'm a data scientist, a machine learning engineer. But with 1904 Labs, I was brought in because I've been leading teams of data scientists for some time. So I was brought in to help build out their what they call decision science, which is data science for the purpose of enhancing and optimizing decision-making for our clients and partner organizations. So the data engineering side of that, which got folded in late last year, is all about building data platforms, data warehouse, databases, and all the technology infrastructure that goes about supporting your data resources as a company. And so that's what I do for 1904 Labs. I lead a team of engineers and data scientists, and we build really great data resources and technology for our clients.
So what's your background? I mean, let's start from where are you from? What were your interests growing up, and why? How did you even get into this?
Yeah. As a kid, I did all the typical kid things, but I'm from the Illinois side of the St. Louis area. I grew up in O'Fallon, Illinois, but my family has a small farm a little further east out in New Baden. As I was going through school, I really liked math. I always really liked math. I was pretty good at it.
You're one of those kids.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I got into college, that's what I decided to study was mathematics and statistics. Coming out of college, I got a job with a marketing company, and right away they asked me to help them with reporting, and I took a look at this reporting and I said, instead of just talking about what did happen, we should be able to use this data and start forecasting what we think is going to happen and then make smart decisions based on that. And that really is when I moved away from just pure math and statistics towards the machine learning world, and I just went deeper and deeper in that machine learning space. I often joke with people that a lot of what you hate about the internet, I had a small hand in developing. So all those ads and
so
those pop-ups.
Yeah, okay.
I'm the guy who decided you are the right person to see that ad. But as our family was growing, my wife, at that time, I was working with companies out of New York City. So I was traveling a lot. And my wife came to me and said, we're going to have another kid. And I just can't do the single parent thing a third of the time. And that's when I got connected with 1904 Labs and with their co-founder, Sean Walsh. So he brought me in to help lead these teams. And we've been doing a lot of really great work for several large clients in St. Louis. We did some really cool work with Mercy in the past. We've done some cool work with Spire Natural Gas, MasterCard. We've got data teams at several of the large clients in St. Louis now doing really cool stuff.
You know, Brandon, dumb this down for all of us a little bit. So let's say a Mercy, or just pick any hypothetical company, comes to you. What is your lane of expertise? What are you helping a corporation really try to accomplish?
Yeah, so Mercy is a good example. So with Mercy, they brought 1904 Labs, which is a bigger tech consulting company. They brought us in to help them build a virtual care platform. So a whole technology platform that allows for patients that are no longer inpatients at the hospital to be released to go home, but they're sent home with a number of IoT Bluetooth connected devices. So heart monitors, pulse oximeters, all kinds of things. And now on a whatever cadence their healthcare professional set up, they need to use those devices. And then we had to create the technology underneath that would pull data off of those devices and then collect that all in some kind of an analytics suite. So healthcare professionals now can look at it and say, okay, heart rate's a little high and it's been high over the last 4 or 5 readings. Let's make this small adjustment to medication or to some other treatment plan, right? Once we had all of this data, then Mercy said, what would be really great is if we could build some machine learning models that would help us estimate patient likelihood of rehospitalization. That way we know they were in our care, we released them home or we thought they were better off for recovery. But if they're not trending in the right way, then we want to stay close to them and we want to know they're trending towards readmission. And so that's one of the more fulfilling projects that we've ever been able to work on, is helping build these machine learning algorithms that gave the healthcare teams a view of within the next 6 months, within the next 9 months, here's their likelihood of rehospitalization. And so now we've got a good window to make adjustments and try and change that outcome for these patients, keeping them at home and keeping them healthy.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I think, isn't that one of the positive applications to this whole AI? Let's stick with healthcare. And I would think, again, just to simplifying this, but there are certain limitations that human beings have with our brains. Or let's just say this, it might take a lot longer to process the data to really help people from a healthcare standpoint. But it sounds like what you're saying is we can gather this data in real time.
Yeah.
And we can come up with some kind of a plan to help an individual with their healthcare needs that maybe the issue that we can help prevent 10 years from now would have never been seen or known before.
Right.
But because of AI and some of the data and historical stuff that we have from other subjects, we've just determined, you have a chance for some kind of diabetes 5 years from now if this doesn't change. Am I overthinking this or this on
no,
the right track?
There are absolutely companies out there now that are looking this at. There's so much information that for humans, we are bombarded with information all the time. We're not so great at ignoring unrelevant information and focusing on only relevant information, whereas with artificial intelligence, with technology, we just limit the information that they're exposed to. And so all you have to think about as an AI algorithm is patient healthcare data. You don't have to worry about financial problems, personal relationship problems. This is all the other information that humans are bombarded with all the time. But with AI, we cut all that out and we just say, worry about this one piece of information and worry about it a lot. Think about it a lot, read about it a lot, learn about it a lot. And so that's where the AI can make big leaps. It's not better at thinking or better at consuming information than humans are, but it can be more focused and targeted. Humans are still much better at receiving and processing information than machines are.
Yeah, machines don't have OCD issues.
No, they don't. No.
that's very helpful.
Yeah.
And I like what you said, even relational things. You just had an argument with the spouse at home. You think you're at your best as you're going in and looking at data? Probably not. We don't have to worry about that with AI. I'm really fascinated by the St. Louis connection to all this.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a Jack Dorsey come out of St. Louis, you have obviously a Sam Altman, who is just an amazing developer and in ChatGPT and all that. Talk a little bit about the St. Louis connection and 1904 Labs and this tech hub that I don't think gets near enough attention, even from St. Louis, but it's pretty dynamic what's happening in this city, is it not?
Oh, yeah. So St. Louis, and one of the reasons why Sean named the company 1904 Labs is after the 1904 World's Fair. A lot happened at the World's Fair from a technological advancement perspective that people don't think about because it was the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. But like 1904 World's Fair was the first time that public lighting and light bulbs and streetlights were shown on a massive scale to where people could walk through the World's Fair and be aided by streetlights that now we all take for granted. It's something everywhere. But that was the first time the world had seen it on this kind of a scale. And there were other large advancements that came out of the World's Fair. And so building on that idea of St. Louis as this kind of innovation hub or center, there have been a lot of great companies that have come out of that. And even in the AI space. So there's a startup called Capacity AI that's really great, that's doing a lot of these voice assistant kind of work. And so, yeah, there's a really strong tech hub, and there's a lot of strong tech consulting groups that are helping to accelerate for all of the large enterprise clients in St. Louis.
Yeah, I would say we should not miss it, because unfortunately, St. Louis is a lot of times in the news for all the wrong things,
sure.
Much of it deservedly so, but there is something really exciting that is happening down there. Yeah. And you can see it right along Highway 40. You can kind of see some of the buildings off to the side.
Well, and I mean, think about the NGA too. So the National Geospatial Agency is going to bring a ton of data and technology minds to St. Louis as they build their new hub in, I guess, North St. Louis. That is going to be so exciting to have all of that. And we do a little bit of work with the NGA right now, but it's fascinating to think about everything we know about all of our maps, everything that you use on your phone for navigation. All of that information is really controlled and maintained by the National Geospatial Agency. Hmm. And so that's they have this base set of map and geospatial information that they then share with all these companies to build their mapping and navigation programs on top of.
One of the other phrases, acronyms, titles, or whatever is this ChatGPT.
Oh, yeah.
First time I came across it, I'd heard about it. And my son, who's very scientifically minded, he's going into medical school and all that stuff, not the best writer in the world. That's not the gift he had. But then again, I didn't get the scientific medical brain. He said, Dad, I want to show you a rec letter. Actually, no, it was a letter that he was writing to medical schools to try for the application process. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, wow, this is brilliant. This is so well written. He's really taken his time. This encapsulates who he is as a young man. This encapsulates his true talents and abilities and what he's trying to accomplish with rural healthcare. That's kind of what he gets into and kind of filling in those gaps. But Brandon, what happened is toward the end, this light bulb went off. I'm like, wait a minute. Is this ChatGPT thing? So I went to him and he kind of sheepishly smiled and he said, yeah, but that was the first time I was exposed to it. It's amazing. So tell us a little bit about that, maybe the history of it, and how does this even work?
Yeah. So ChatGPT is part of a larger class of AI models that we call large language models. For all AI, for all machine learning, the premise is all the same. There's an algorithm that sits in the middle. You put information in, it does something with that information, and then it spits information out. That's the base of how this works. So with ChatGPT, you provide it some prompt with some kind of context. It considers that, and given whatever you've asked it to do, then it produces some kind of text on the back end. There's other big models now that people are excited about that take in text and produce images, or they take in images and they produce text, or they take in images and they produce images. But it's all information in one side, crunch, 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 information out the other side.
So it's only as good as the information going in. And is that one of the problems, that maybe it'll spit out false information, correct?
Yeah. So we've really recently, we've been thinking about how do you take something like a ChatGPT and make it so that it's safe and protected, so that a large client like a Wells Fargo or an Ed Jones could use that in their website and have the confidence to know it's not going to make up information. If somebody comes to it and says, I need to reset my password, or I need to, a routine kind of customer service request, how do we use ChatGPT so that it doesn't respond with, passwords are dumb, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. That's not helpful.
right.
So, but there are ways, and it is in that information that you feed in. It's that context around the request that really matters. And so there are all kinds of really cool ways that you can use kind of existing technology that people are all comfortable with, the kind of technology you use for search engines, where you go out into the knowledge base of a company, you search and you pull back the pieces of their knowledge base that matter, and you include that in your prompt. And then you tell ChatGPT something like, you are a customer service rep for a large financial company. Using only this information below, the following five paragraphs, answer the following question. Boom. Well, now it knows exactly what information to read and pull from. It knows exactly what persona to use in its response. And most of the time, I'm not going to say all the time, but all the times as we've experimented with it, it produces a really great response with all kinds of relevant information. But we had to go through that search engine exercise up front to go out and look for what we need and pull that back and then include it in the prompt.
You know, I'm starting to connect the dots here when you're using this term of search engine, because the last 25 years or so, we just hear Google.
Right.
And others, but Google is it. And it's become almost that all-encompassing name. Google it.
It's the Kleenex of the internet.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. But what I hear in the financial area and from analysts going, well, Google as a company has kind of missed it a little bit. And there are other companies that are starting to fill the void, and Google better get on track. And apparently, from what I understand, I'm not a stock analyst, but from what I understand, they are now starting to say, oh, yeah, we better get involved here. But what you're saying is the whole concept of what we've known as search engines is changing.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, it certainly will. Yeah. Bing made that first move. So OpenAI with their GPT platform, they came out, and then Bing, a couple weeks later, partners with them and said, now everything you do on Bing search, you can turn on the use of OpenAI to enhance that search result. So now, if you need an answer to a question, we will search the internet, we will pull back information, we'll provide that to GPT, and it can answer the question for you. Rather than making you click through all our links and read a bunch of articles, we'll save you all that step. And everybody was like, oh, Microsoft, they're beating Google to the game. Well, none of these things happen overnight. It's not like Google saw that announcement and then went to their developers and was like, we need this. Google has also been working on this for years.
All right.
And so the announcement made by Bing accelerated maybe what Google was ready to announce, but probably not. They were probably on the same timeline anyways, because less than a month later, Google at its developer conference makes the announcement now that they're going to be integrating their own large language model, which is called Bard. I don't know. It's an acronym. I don't remember exactly what it stands for. But Bard now, which is as good as OpenAI's GPT platform, is going to be useful in Google search results too.
Got it. So ChatGPT, as you're inferring here, basically it has access to the entire internet of data, stored data, right? And that it will literally go in and has the ability to mine, I don't know how much data is out there, an infinite amount, I guess, and then immediately come back with something. Is that a simplistic way, I guess, to look at it?
So what I would say is there's GPT at its core, and all of these large language models at their core, they are text prediction algorithms. And so it's given some amount of context, I need you to predict the next word that should be written.
Okay.
Now, as that word's added, now given all of this existing context, predict the next word. And so it's really good. And where it excels that other language models have not is it can consider much more context in predicting the next word than a lot of these other language models have in the past. And so years ago, you could find a text generator and you could giggle and laugh at how impressive it was. But after one sentence, it didn't know how to start the next thought. Whereas GPT can construct entire essays and it knows all of that context and they're cohesive and they're coherent. And it's because it can consider much more. And I don't want to say memory because as far as I understand, it doesn't have a memory but it has much more to consider as it estimates the next word, and then it's really good at building full thoughts and cohesive thoughts.
Yeah, before we leave that, I do want to then explore a little bit more about the imperfection of it, I guess, in that we've already sort of touched on it, that it's only as good as the data that it mines and sees or that's fed into it. I assume that over time, that will just get better and better and better and more efficient. But we're here today in 2023. And I think one of the fears that a lot of people have is that we are going to be fed some misinformation. It leads to more fake news. It leads to more disinformation. And that's an issue, right? That we've got to be aware of when we read things, that they could be the fake whatever. Some of it's intentional, but some of it's not. I saw a guy on television say, I tested it through ChatGPT, and I said, tell me what was so amazing about the Le Mans race of 2008. And he said something like that. He goes, it's so funny because that was actually a very famous race for this reason, and the response got it all wrong. It didn't even read correctly what actually happened at the end, which was controversial. It yeah. missed the entire controversy. So it's still imperfect.
Right. And so with that specific example, there's been a new title or position that gets talked about a lot. We talk about large language models, which is this idea of a prompt engineer, someone who builds a sufficient prompt with the right kind of context in it to produce a strong result. And so this, at least in the near term, I don't know how long this position will need to exist, but for anybody that's using these models for a purpose, getting the prompts right has a lot to do. It's all information in, mm-hmm. crunch, information out. So the information you put into it is very, very important. And in that example, if you wanted to know about this Le Mans race, yes, in learning to write the next word, they have exposed these large language models to essentially the entire text of the internet.
Right.
They put a recency limit on it. So you can't read anything published in the last 2 years, two months. And that is just to protect personal people and whatever is happening right now. But while they've used that to learn how to write words, they're not considering all of that information when they write the word. It's not like these large language models do not have a memory or a knowledge base that they're pulling from. It's not like they're going to Wikipedia when you ask a question about Le Mans and looking up Le Mans and reading it in that moment. Instead, they're taking the context of what you've put in your prompt, and they're using that plus what they've learned about guessing the next word to produce this response. Mm-hmm. So yes, they've read the whole internet, but they don't remember it all. They haven't built a knowledge base. It's not as if that whole internet got loaded into a brain and they're pulling from that brain. Mm-hmm. That's not how large language models work. All they're trying to do is predict the next word, but do it in a remarkably human-sounding way. This may be not the right time in the podcast to get into this, but part of how these large language models were developed is they used what's called reinforcement learning, and many of them used humans in the loop with this, where we feed in some kind of a prompt, crunch, 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 and it spits out a response. When those responses are good, the model itself is rewarded for human-like responses. When they're bad or when they're incoherent, then it's penalized for those. And we can do that in an automated way of this was good, this was bad, or we can do it with a human actually reading it, which is for ChatGPT, a lot of what it was is they experimented and they played with a large user group of chat with this and tell us when it's good, when it's bad, what it got wrong, what it got right. Mm-hmm. And it's that feedback that made it more and more human to where, at least for the first few responses, it's indistinguishable.
Yeah.
You would never know.
Brandon, is there a big bang, if you will, of this technology that you're talking about? Can we point to one individual or one group of data scientists to say, that's where ChatGPT was born, that's the genesis of it? Is it easy to point to that, or is it just something that has just morphed from technology that we've had for decades?
There, yes and no. So they've been working on this problem. There was a group at MIT, I think back in the 60s, that tried to build a text generation engine. And it was all logic and rules based. It wasn't machine learning and deep learning based. And so it would write. It didn't write well. But the fact that they could get words out of it, like, well, they were impressed with. So it's been around for decades. But yes, the advancements in machine learning and really the movement towards deep learning is what makes a lot of this possible. The problem with deep learning is that inside the algorithm, there are a lot of unknowns. With standard machine learning statistical approaches, we understand the mechanisms by which decisions are made. Inside deep learning, we intentionally run very complex algorithms where we know generally what's happening, but not specifically, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so people are afraid of that because they hear that and they think, well, you don't even know how it works. Well, we do. We know generally what's going on, but it's all happening inside to where, no, I can't specifically speak to you about it, but I know what it's doing. I just don't know exactly how it made decisions one over the other. Mm-hmm. But it's that deep learning approach to producing answers that have really accelerated this. Now with GPT, OpenAI was started by a number of wealthy, forethinking individuals. They came together and said, we want to create a group that will progress the development of artificial intelligence, but do it in such a way that it's made open and available to everyone. The fear was that the wealthiest companies in the world would control the greatest technologies, mm-hmm. and then that would hinder their advancement for humanity. So OpenAI has a very lofty and ethical goal, I guess mm-hmm. you could say. But in doing that, yes, they were able to really progress the development of these large language models. And, you know, over the course of like 2 or 3 years, they went from not having anything to having the ChatGPT that was released for everyone.
I wasn't planning on asking you about this,
okay.
but you've kind of brought it up. And you even said sort of something interesting that I picked up at the beginning about, yeah, you know, jokingly, we can blame you for some of that stuff and the creating of the algorithms.
Yeah.
But on a serious note, this is what has really caused companies like a Facebook to get in trouble with the feds, with regulators, sure. even the general public. Well, wait a minute. I've used Facebook all these years. I didn't know you were mining my data. Mm-hmm. I didn't know you were selling it. Oh, that makes sense. No wonder when I search for something, I get 5 emails that come back. Hey, you might want to try this. And I'm thinking, how do you know that I want to try that? Well, they've developed these algorithms that do that. I think I understand the original purpose of that. But there has been a dark side that has developed from that, because now, as we well know, and Twitter has really had to fight on this, you get this feedback loop. And I want to talk specifically politically here about that, which has really been quite divisive. And mm-hmm. I think what happens over time, very slowly, let's say you are one side of the political aisle and you have an interest in what this one person has to say. Like, well, that's interesting. And you might provide a comment or a feedback. And then you get more hits of that particular person. And then all of a sudden, you're getting some hits from other similar people. And you find yourself going down this rabbit hole on one side. You don't know you're being pulled that way.
Yeah.
But it's happening. So where on a football field of politics, where 50-yard line is in the middle, or you're at the 30-yard line, moderate Democrat, 30-yard line, moderate Republican, you don't know, but now you are on the extreme end zone side. You don't know that it's happened to
yeah,
you.
You've drifted. Yeah.
But this is all because of this feedback loop. That take all of this as a question, I guess, but okay. I would like you to address the issues that people have had with this.
Yeah. So let's talk about the marketing. Well, let's talk about the content, internet content side of things. On your social platforms, the mechanism that they're using is similar to what we talked about with the GPT and this idea of reinforcement. Mm-hmm. So when you see an ad and you like that ad, you are reinforcing a decision that they made about the content that you see. And so not that I'm encouraging anyone to be stingy with their likes, like what you like, that's mm-hmm. fine. But that is the signal that they're using to determine what other content. Now, they don't say specifically, you liked this ad, so now I've got this other ad I want to show you. Instead, what they do is when you like that, they're capturing information about you as an individual, and they're trying to classify you into one of many groups. They're not going to put you into one box. They're going to put you in a whole bunch. Mm-hmm. And now, as an advertiser, I come in and I say, well, I really would like to expose my ad to people on the conservative side of the spectrum with this income range that live in these markets. And because you liked that piece of content, whatever— now, the next ad that you show will be for the Republican senator or congressman running in your district. Right? But as a product and as a business, if you want to market, and you know that this specific group likes your brand, you're receiving two pieces of information. One is, do I now make my marketing materials speak to that audience? Should I make my marketing content speak to conservatives and speak to issues that conservatives care about? They also now can target you. And so it's not only did I as a marketer learn I need to customize my message to this audience, but now I need to double down on who sees this. And they'll do as much as they can with the audiences that are very close to what they know, and then they're going to expand beyond that. And this is where people start to drift, is you now have content that speaks a politically polarized viewpoint, be it conservative or liberal, and you're now going not to the group you know loves you, but the group that might, because we need to expand that audience. And so now we're going to pull some of those people who might, if they like our ad, we're going to pull them closer to that conservative. And they go from being moderate at the 30 to at the 10.
Yeah. Is this just what we're going to have to deal with, or is this something that's being combated now? Where do we stand on all this?
So as a user, there are ways to reset your stream on some of these platforms. You can go and you can say, reset my For You stream, or, you know, my Instagram stream. So now they basically go back to, all right, we're going to wipe everything we know about you, and we're going to call you a general audience again, and we're going to use your likes and your favorites or whatever else, your responses, your retweets, and we're going to rebuild this profile on you. So if you're very frustrated with what you're seeing on your feed, look in your settings and you can try to reset it. I don't always recommend that, because you're going to be like, where's all the videos I did like?
Yeah, right,
they're not there anymore.
Right.
So as a user, you have some control if you're like, I just need to get away from this issue. I also say we've highlighted the one area where people get frustrated, but what percentage of your feed is that frustrating material? Are you going to give up the 90% of content from your friends and your family that you like to see, that you really want to put likes on, give up all of that because there's this one problem? We can fix the problem without throwing away everything that works and that makes Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and people love those platforms because of the feed and the social connection they get out of it. Don't throw that all away just because you're being served ads that you don't really like.
Yeah, that's well said. It really is personal responsibility, honestly. It's intentional. I speak for myself here. I purposely, even though I lean to one side politically, I purposely watch both sides. I think, just forget about all the social media stuff, I think it's important that we do that anyway.
Yeah.
And you just have to be more well-rounded. But I'm a big YouTube person.
Sure.
And so I subscribe to a lot of different channels. But if you looked at my subscriptions, it does run both sides. Now, I will say one side can drive me crazy a little bit, but that's true with anybody.
Yeah.
That's why I don't feel like I'm constantly getting bombarded or fed on one side. But I never thought about what you just said. And it's interesting that, yeah, we do talk about that 10% that drives people crazy.
Yeah.
But 90% or more of it's all good. Frankly,
right.
on YouTube, I'm watching rock videos and I'm watching really interesting tidbits on how to fix my bike tire and
right.
stuff like that. But there is that part that we have to be very, very intentional about. Let's go back on the positive side of things before
sure.
we leave AI on that, and because there's some other things that are very concerning that I think people would like for you to address. But before we do that, I don't want to miss anything yet. We've talked about the potential for healthcare advantages mm-hmm. and people having things determined before it's too late. What are some other really positive applications with this new technology,
Absolutely.
With AI, that can really help humankind the next number of decades?
Yeah. So I had an interesting conversation, and this was a few weeks ago. A friend of mine is a math teacher at a high school, and we were talking about ChatGPT, and he's like, you can go to this thing with any essay, with any homework question, you can give it the homework question, and it'll produce an answer for you, and that answer is right 95% of the time. Why would kids ever do their own homework anymore? And I said, the goal of homework was never to get the answer right. The goal of homework is to reinforce what you've learned and to validate that you've learned that information. And so if you're a teacher now, view ChatGPT as an always-on tutor for your students. And you have to reshape the purpose of homework, because I think a lot of times kids go home with homework and education and they think, all right, this is to prove to my teacher that I get it. So it's not for me, it's for them. They need to know I was paying attention. They need to know I've learned. So there are, and have always been, students who will cheat They're going to go out and they've saved their older siblings' homework from the years before. Or they just went and searched the internet and found an answer that somebody posted on Reddit or something else. So the cheating has always happened. I don't think this is necessarily cheating. I think you can go to GPT now and you can say, I don't understand this section of the book. And you can copy in entire pages or paragraphs and say, can you explain this to me? And so what I told this friend is I said, instead of worrying about whether or not they are using ChatGPT, make them. Instead, say, I am, as a math teacher, here is a word problem. I want you to give this word problem to ChatGPT, but I need you to write a prompt so that it produces a really great answer. And then I need you to share with me the prompt that you wrote, and then I need you to share with me its response and what you think it got right and what you think it got wrong. They're learning as much about that problem by going through that exercise, and they went ahead and used ChatGPT. You made them use GPT, ChatGPT, Google Bard, whatever. But now they've had to learn. And that's an amazing skill set because this technology is not going away. Everybody wants to talk about, should we or shouldn't we? Do we need to shut this down? You cannot. Yeah. It's done.
It's out in the open.
And so now it's a matter of, we need to make sure we use this technology for the benefit of humanity in great ways rather than allowing this technology to be used to our detriment.
Man, I'm glad you addressed that specifically with education, because frankly, that's been one of my big concerns. My dad is a longtime retired college professor, so I grew up in an educational family. And we've seen that the art of just cursive handwriting has died.
Yeah.
And I lament that. Now, is it the old guy just going, oh, it was better back in my day?
Yeah.
Is it really that important? I don't know. As long as the kids are using their brain to put together sentences, fine. Okay, that's where we are today. It is what it is. But my fear with ChatGPT is, well, we're not even going to allow the kids to think anymore. They're going to lose that ability over time because they're just going to go to do their homework. Oh, I've got to write an essay on the American Revolution, and particularly on Samuel Adams. Okay, hey, ChatGPT, write me an essay on what made Samuel Adams great. I'm going to go get a Diet Coke in the fridge, and I'll be back in 5 minutes. Is that even possible? Or what you're saying is, well, it depends on the teacher and the educational system. It's there, but if used in the proper way, and you teach kids to use it in the best way, it can be a wonderful tool.
Yes. Absolutely. The point of homework and the point of tests and the point of essays isn't to prove to the teacher that you got it right. It's an exercise in reflecting and using a thought process. And so focus on that and then bring ChatGPT in as a tool and make everybody use it. That way it's not cheating. You had to, but now the assignment has changed. You have to use ChatGPT and it has to produce an essay. And then you have to analyze that essay. And you have to tell me what it got right and what it got wrong, and tell me if the sources that it cites are real sources. Mm-hmm. And now I've taught you how to do research on sources. And so it's a tool for education if you change the way. But, teachers that have given the same test for years, this requires them to do something different, which I fully understand they weren't intending to do, at least not yet, not now. It's a shift in the paradigm, but I think it's better if you look at it the right way.
One more potential positive, and I want to get back to healthcare. That's really a big thing for me, longevity. Mm-hmm. Does AI help solve some of the, man's greatest issues in terms of, let's say, finding a cure for cancer or Alzheimer's research? I'm not saying that it's all of a sudden going to do miracles tomorrow, but some of the things that have vexed human ingenuity and human research, and it's just taken a long, long time. Is it possible that AI could speed up that process and go, well, you've never looked at it this way.
Right.
If you put this and this together, and some scientist is like, wow, that's terrific. Is that a potential positive?
Yeah. So I'm going to start on the marketing side and then I'll bring it back to healthcare. Mm-hmm. On the marketing side, what we've always done is we've always taken what we know about the audience that connects to our brand. And we've said, what do we know about this audience and how can we find other groups that aren't the same, but they're very similar? Or how can we estimate the likelihood of good responses from other audiences based on what we know about our core demographic. Imagine a similar situation applied in healthcare, where we know this treatment works for these symptoms with this condition. Let's now look at other conditions and other symptoms, and let's see if this treatment could be applied anywhere else, right? And I know of startups that are trying to answer this question. Now, what AI is really, really good at is finding relationships in unobvious places. And so, yeah, as we start to apply AI to the health and medical world, and we create this big data set that includes all of the treatments, all of the symptoms, all of the corresponding results, and then we look at what haven't we explored in Alzheimer's? What other treatments could we try in Alzheimer's? Is there something we haven't investigated yet? And then we go after it. The other thing that AI is really advancing is any of the work in the genetic space.
Yeah.
And so as we get into the super micro, the cellular, that's where AI is going to be really, really beneficial because it can simulate through a bunch of options and then identify pathways with the highest likelihood for success.
Let's talk about some of the jobs out there, old line traditional jobs that might be in jeopardy.
Yeah, sure.
I don't think we can avoid that. And I'm pulling out here, this was in Barron's over the past week or two. And it says a recent study analyzed occupational exposure to AI language modeling. Here are the top 10. Number one at risk is telemarketers, which is, we can kind of all laugh about that. And I can see that. But here's the interesting thing, and the reason I point this out. Numbers 2 through 9, so 8 of them, are all in the same profession, teaching. But not elementary school, not high school. And I think, and this is just me guessing, I think the reason for that is we still need the socialization of kids to be in school. Boy, did we learn that during the pandemic.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
We're seeing some of the real negative side effects of kids not being in the classroom.
Right.
I'll put that aside. This is all what they call post-secondary.
Yep.
College, master's, PhD. So number two, beyond telemarketers, most at risk of being wiped out as a job, as a profession, is English language and lit teachers, post-secondary. Third is foreign language teachers. And then it goes on down. Political science teachers, criminal justice and law enforcement teachers, post-secondary. Is there something to this, you think?
Well, so let's think about what college is. When you, in college, is the first time you are really taught and forced to teach yourself in many ways. And so, yeah, what ChatGPT, what other large language models present is an always-on tutor to help you think through and learn your problems. So most of what my college experience was is you're going to read this section of the book, you're going to do these problems, and then you're going to come to lecture. And if you have questions, I'll answer them. If not, we'll call it for the day.
Yeah.
So that teacher, other than developing our lesson plan and the content we had to read and breaking it up, that teacher, their primary focus in their job isn't necessarily teaching lectures to college students. It's the research and the promotion of the university that they do and spend many and much of their time on. So I don't think their job is going away, but I think absolutely a lot of what they've really not wanted to focus on anyways, I think a lot of that can be automated. And I think that's 100% true for many of the jobs on that list. We heard ChatGPT can pass the bar exam. And so does this mean the end of lawyers? No. Somebody said, well, if Chat, and this, someone actually said this to me in a presentation once. They said, if ChatGPT can write a legal brief, what do we need junior associate lawyers for? And I said, you need junior associate lawyers so that you can get senior associate lawyers, so that you can get litigators, so that like, that first step in their career of primarily writing briefs for somebody else gives them experience so that they move to the next step in their career. And ChatGPT or any large language model won't replace that thing. So yes, it can aid them in this one task, but we still need them so that we can get to the next step, which we can't skip step one to get to step two. So they didn't want to write that brief anyways. They can use ChatGPT to help them write it. But their position isn't going away. It's necessary for the other positions that we need in society.
So you, Brandon, who is an expert in this, I like what you're saying, because you're not really buying into a lot of the true fears that people have, that virtually every job in some capacity in 10 years will be gone, and it will be all automated and run by robots. There still is a place for human beings in these various professions, because what you're saying is a lot of this is the aid to it. It's like having a good aide next to us. It's having a coworker. But at the end of the day, a lot of these professions still need you and I at the helm, right?
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, the market will change. Will there be fewer customer service telemarketing representatives?
Yes, right.
Absolutely there will. Yeah. That wasn't the job these people aspired to do in life anyways.
Yeah.
So for those individuals working in that industry, you might want to think about what your next step in your career is and how you move towards that.
But you see that at grocery stores, by the way.
Yeah.
More and more is self-check. And I went to a grocery store in Texas, early spring. It was the first one I had seen where there were no checkers.
Yeah.
And I felt sorry for, I observed this for a while. I love to do this kind of thing. And I sat back and I watched some of the older folks show up who didn't know this was going to happen. And I felt for them.
Yeah.
So that's part of the issue. But it is coming. As you said, some of those tasks where you don't grow up wanting to aspire to, it might be a transition to something else.
Right.
Or it might be that college job that you have will be automated.
Right. And that, I believe, is good for society. I mean, during the pandemic, we saw there weren't enough workers to run fast food restaurants.
Good point, yeah.
Right? You know, so there will be some automation that's needed. And in those areas, I expect the market to move faster, where there isn't enough workers or it's not the kind of work that people want to do anymore. So now we have to fill that void with something else. But I mean, it will take not like decades, but it's going to take at least a couple years for any of this to really take hold and then get deployed. So it's not immediate. It's not like you need to be worried that in a couple of weeks you're going to show up and there's going to be a letter that says all of our call staff is now laid off because we hired so-and-so technology and they're going to do it all for us. At 1904 Labs, we build customer service, AI-enabled customer service phone lines. But we do this so that we can take a lot of the burden off of the call staff. And so if you're calling into a bank because you want to check your balance, which I understand is something most people don't call to do anymore, but as an example, that can be fully automated.
Yeah.
You can go through an AI and provide your account number and provide some kind of a passcode, and then we give you your balance. You don't have to sit in the queue on hold waiting for a representative to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And any of those easily automatable things, we will. Or even if it's just collecting information before you get to an agent. So because how frustrating is it to talk to one person, provide your account name, number, blah, blah, blah. They say, oh, you really needed to talk to accounts payable. Let me transfer you to them.
Right.
You got to do it again. Provide it once. And now every time a person picks up the phone or anytime you're transitioned, your entire history is made available to them before they pick up the phone. And so then they can say, Dave, hi, Brandon, we've never met before. I'm in accounts payable. I've read through everything and everything that you were talking with Elise about before. I'm so glad she transferred you to me. I can help you. Great. That makes your customer experience so much better. And you had to interact with a robot for just a little bit to do that.
Yeah. I actually, in my profession as a certified financial planner and looking at building investment models, I actually see some positive applications here. I really do. I won't dig too deep into that, but I want to stay on the investing side. I'm not asking you for specific ideas. I'm not giving specific ideas. So we'll keep this at a 30,000 foot view. But is there anything that you would tell people who are looking at maybe helping to profit from this from an investment standpoint? Are there some general areas of AI, ChatGPT, all of this technological revolution, as we look back at the internet, we'll look at these kinds of things. Cloud computing is going to come out. Look at that cybersecurity. You might want to look at those types of companies. Let's fast forward to today. What are some of the exciting opportunities that you would tell someone about?
So the history of the internet would tell us to look at the platforms that stand to make ad revenue off of these advancements in AI. And I think Facebook, the major platforms, I think Facebook most recently had the announcement about this, where they are going to bring a lot of these AI capabilities to their marketing and advertising tools on across the Meta platform of companies. And so that's exciting because now brands, small brands or big brands, can use Adobe's new AI tools, which I think are powered by Google Bard. But now you can say, okay, I want to create a picture of this and this and this, and I want it to look like this style. And it's boom, you've got ad creative that you can roll a Facebook ad with. And so I would look at, if I were an investor, I'd look at the big companies and what they're doing with AI to enhance their existing technologies. Apple made their big announcement this week at the Worldwide Developer Conference, where they've now got the Apple Vision, I think is what it's called. Really cool. Mm-hmm. It uses a ton of AI to produce that experience for you. They want you to think that you're looking through a clear lens. You're not. You're looking into screens. Anyone that looks at you from the outside, there are cameras that have taken a picture of your face, and so they're producing what your eyes would maybe look like.
That's crazy.
But so there's AI in all of this stuff, and I'd focus on those big companies, the Apple, the Google, the Microsofts of the world, and keep an eye on Amazon, of course, what they're doing, and then follow them.
That's interesting because as we record this coming up in mid-June, you look at the stock market and its performance this year, and a lot of hay has been made about this. The S&P 500, as we're recording this, is up a little bit more than 10% for the year. All of that gain has been led by seven stocks, and they're being called the Magnificent Seven. And they're all related in some way to AI. It is Microsoft and Apple and Amazon. Even Tesla, that's one of the seven, but that basically is a tech company that makes cars, right? The other 493 companies in the S&P have been irrelevant this year. Now, that can't go on forever. You do have to spread that out a little bit. But I like what you're saying because that's what I've been telling investors at the same time. Look, I know everyone wants to find the next Facebook. Everyone wants to find the next new Apple that nobody knows about. Sorry, you'll never do that because you don't work in Silicon Valley, and that's private equity and all this other startup money's coming into that. You'll never be lucky enough to get on the ground floor, but you don't have to because they're already existing. Apple is not the same company that Steve Jobs started. So you have to give Tim Cook and other people the credit for actually totally revamping the company. Google is not the same company as it was as it started out 30 like years
Eric
ago. Microsoft is not the Bill Gates company we know. So recognize that. Don't get caught up in what these companies have been in the past. Give the recognition to their management to say, we've got new technology, and you stick with the big boys. These are not buy recommendations, but again, just some advice to say, you don't have to dig into the weeds to find some new startup that you've never heard of that you're not going to get in anyway. The big boys are leading. Now, on the negative side is that crowding out? Do they just keep getting bigger? It's like the banks. We keep getting fewer banks and they're bigger and bigger. Is that potentially what could happen here in technology?
Potentially. But I mean, one of the companies you listed is less than a decade old. Tesla built their entire company over the past few years. Mm-hmm. So it's possible for disruptors to come in and challenge the big boys. But what Tesla did, which is maybe worth talking about in this discussion, that I think is really fascinating, when you look at the other large auto manufacturers, as they've been building their cars and they've been adding technology to their cars, they've gone to multiple different vendors to build software for them. So they needed an ECU, an engine control unit, you know, technology manual sensor that goes in the engine. Well, they allowed the company that builds that ECU to write the software so that it runs. And that software just has to integrate with everything else. But then as they've built their entire car, they've got hundreds of these sensors throughout the car, if not, you know, thousands of them or whatever. How many different pieces of software were written by different companies on different platforms to bring that together? Whereas Tesla went in and said, we control all of the software in this car. No matter what, it's going to be written by us. It's going to be controlled and managed by us. And by having that vertical integration, they became a software company that applied their software to the automotive space. And so that is what I think is exciting. And that's something that I think all of the major U.S. automakers now are trying to figure out. They're scrambling a little bit as they want to move towards electric vehicles. But now the software is almost more important than the electric motors and the battery packs that go in there, because the whole car is technology and it all has to integrate and work seamlessly. And so they're reinventing their entire technology suite.
First time I ever got into a Tesla, the first thing I thought is, I'm driving a computer.
Yeah.
It's a computer on four wheels. Mm-hmm. It is. I don't own one, but I have friends who do, and it is fascinating. So I appreciate your comments. All right, pivot here.
Okay.
I'm going to read a couple of things that I printed out. One of them, AI poses extinction risk, say experts. This is really interesting in that you had a group of industry chiefs recently get together. They're experts. They've been involved in AI, ChatGPT, and they issued a one-line statement. And I'll quote part of it, that risks from AI should be, quote, a global priority. Now, these are risks they're talking about from the experts. A global priority alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to stop there for a second. There are folks kind of on the front line who say, we just need to kind of watch this. And they're comparing the potential of a nuclear war with where we can be going with AI. And one more, the godfather of AI, a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Hinton, has left Google. And he's going to spend the rest of his life warning about the technology that he kind of helped found. This is what people read, mm-hmm. and this is what concerns them. Are they wrong? Is there something there? You've talked about responsibility that we all have, but where are we going with this?
Yeah. So the alarmists, the individuals that you've talked about, they are speaking in response to AI that you and I have not seen. They have seen something that's much more advanced than the ChatGPTs of the world. And so that's what they're afraid of. I think they have every right to be alarmed. Now, whatever it is that they're afraid of or whatever future that they've seen, I don't think that average individuals necessarily need to be worried about it. They're doing everything right in that they're raising the alarm, they're throwing up the warning flag. They need to do this so that we can have protocols, procedures, guardrails in place so that whatever technology they're afraid of, whenever it does make it to the general population, we've been safeguarded to where it can't have the negative impacts. So while everyone's afraid of this, this is part of the process of protecting us from the technologies that they have seen.
Now, I started the podcast in kind of a lighthearted way, talking about these movies like, yeah. you know, iRobot and 2001 Space Odyssey. But I do want to get your honest opinion, and that's all we have right now, just opinions. We can't know 50 years from now what this thing's going to look like. But do you actually worry about the possibility that robots someday can start building their own robots, and then they take on human qualities, and then they actually can figure things out like, we don't need humans anymore. Oh, and by the way, I can figure out the access code to the nuclear codes that this particular country has. We're going to wipe. I'm being very dystopian. I admit this is all fantasy stuff. But is it? Not yeah. the next 5 years, 10 years, 100 years? What are the possibilities here?
So the possibilities are as you've described. Absolutely, there's a future that we get to from the point we're at now where robots look at humans and say, you disagree, you can't reach common goals, you're not promoting the betterment of society, you're just bickering and fighting, therefore you are the problem, and I have a recourse to eliminate the problem, and I will. In order for that future to arrive, this is not encouraging, but in order for that future to arrive, they no longer need to be dependent on us.
Yeah.
And so at this point, humans are the ones that produce energy, produce power, and that's what all of technology needs. So the incentives are off right now for them to eliminate humanity, mm-hmm. I guess is maybe the saving grace. but also consider it a warning to all of humanity that I don't want this to be the case, but if we are aware of why robots would take action against humanity, then we need to not give them that reality. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that we as a human race are the best thing this planet has going for it, and then robots would have no reason to eradicate us.
Yeah, and it's also being talked about war, right? Where, hey, we don't have to worry about sending our men and women to the front lines anymore. It's already sort of happening with drones and all that.
I mean, look at the war in Ukraine, yeah.
Oh, yeah, but we just say, well, so some people fear that we'll have even more wars and more geographical disputes because we don't have to risk human life. Again, that gets very dystopian. Here's part of my personal issue, and I'm just speaking for myself as someone who's in their early 60s. One of the things that I've noticed over time, watching relatives get older, watching people I know get older, is the world does become a scarier place. It just does. I think that's part of the human condition, and that the core of that is a lack of understanding a technological advance. We don't get it, therefore, we fear it. And I've told my own kids, I don't want to be that guy. So if you hear your old man when he's 80 some years old going, oh boy, I don't know. I'm glad I'm close to death. And I hear that. I'm glad I'm not being born today.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be that guy. So I've told my kids, you have permission to call me out. So I'm wondering, Brandon, is that part of this that we have a concern, while we need to address it, that maybe it really is not as bad as we think. And it really stems from the fact that we don't understand it. And this is going to be 99% good. And we can control the 1% that's bad. And we could have a future machine and go and look 200 years from now and be amazed at how wonderful life is. And we've eradicated cancer and Alzheimer's, and we all get along. Now I'm being, very utopian. But I don't think we can discount that as a possibility either, right?
Right. So there's a little bit of a hubris problem for people. The assumption is when a new technology comes out, I don't understand it, therefore it must be a bad thing, right? Well, just because you don't understand it doesn't mean that no one does. There are absolutely people in the world who understand this technology at a much deeper level than you or I or most people do. And so the fact that they created it and then they released it meant they believe on some level that it's safe enough to expose to everybody. But there's that hubris problem where it's like, well, I don't understand it and I'm a really smart person. Therefore, it has to, this guy must be crazy. Well, no, it's just, you haven't learned. You don't need to be afraid of everything. Now, to the alarmists that you quoted earlier, like, there are very smart people in the world that are raising these issues, and you don't need to share in their fear, because what they're raising alarms about is not the same thing, the same technology that you are exposed to. But you should be grateful that they are, because their cries for help will lay the groundwork for the protection that society needs as this technology continues to advance.
Yeah. I do want to address something else, too, on deepfakes and fraud. I just read a very interesting story, and I had to reread it. I thought, this is unbelievable to me. But China, apparently, is having more of a problem with this, and they've called the government into action. And this was in the Wall Street Journal, and it's just one particular example. A guy gets a call or an email from a friend and says, hey, I'd like to set up a video chat. And over there, they use WeChat. And, I haven't talked to you in a while. It'd be great to see your face. Okay, so they set it up. True story, by the way. So these two Chinese men are having a discussion. And one of the guys, the guy who initiated it, said, I actually need some help and I need a loan. And it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And apparently he called the right guy, because this guy has that kind of money, apparently. So he lends it to him. He then calls his buddy a little time after and said, hey, I've wired the money. I just want to check. You want to check your bank to see if you've got it? And the guy goes, I have no idea what you're talking about. Our conversation that we just had on WeChat. I saw your face. I heard your voice. You told me you needed the money. I just wired you the money. And the guy goes, I seriously don't have any idea what you're talking about. Now, this guy must feel like he's suddenly in an Alfred Hitchcock movie. He's probably having an out-of-body experience. True story. He calls the authorities. Now, fortunately, they were able to stop most of it because normally you cannot wire a huge chunk of money. It has to be in smaller increments. But some of it did leave. Brandon, what happened is this criminal element, did they go on a Facebook or something? But they found the face of this friend, of a friend, and they must have found some video to get his voice. But somehow the technology exists for these criminal elements who had to have some intelligence to create this deep fake with the voice that suckered this guy into giving that kind of money.
I shouldn't laugh.
That's amazing to me. So how do we... I don't know how you combat that. And I think about in my own industry where if I get an email from a client, hey, I need you to wire 25 grand, we have to pick up the phone. We can't just use an email.
Yeah.
That's the way it should be. But I would think that if I'm doing a Zoom call with a client and I see his face and he's telling me I'm okay, but maybe not.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to have to create, in that situation, before he wires the guy money, he needed to verify the need through some other channel. Mm-hmm. I completely understand why he didn't see the need in the moment to do that. He looked right in the face. Here's his voice. There's no reason for me to doubt Dave is asking me for money. Mm-hmm. But in moving forward now, it's okay. When we're off of here, I'm going to give you a call on your personal cell phone and I'm going to send you an email. And I would need, I need to verify through both of those channels that you need this, right? Mm-hmm. Great. Now, if that hacker is really smart, then they've already patched their way into the phone line to receive calls. And like, there are still ways around it, but we're going to have to explore alternative ways of validating the need and validating the endpoint. I mean, that's,
it's part of the evolution of this, right?
It's just, we have to put securities, the checks and balances around these things. And so I'm very sorry for that individual that, that they were deepfaked. Usually when we talk about deepfakes, and my wife, is, she was a speech and theater teacher in high schools for years. And so she cares a lot about the entertainment industry. She, both of my sister-in-laws and brother-in-law are in the entertainment industry. So, she's like, well, now you can go out and you can make an entire movie with Tom Hanks in it.
I've thought about that. Sure.
Yeah. And Tom Hanks was never in it. It'll have his voice and it'll have his face. And I go, yeah, but it's not Tom Hanks. It looks like Tom Hanks. It sounds like Tom Hanks, but it's not Tom Hanks. And she's like, well, you shouldn't even be allowed to do that. I'm like, you can draw pictures of Tom Hanks. You maybe can't sell them and make money on them without his approval. But I said, so I agree. You shouldn't be able to profit off of somebody else's likeness without sharing that profit with that person. I agree with that. That is legal problems somebody else has to settle, financial problems somebody else has to settle. Creating the art, I don't have a problem with. As long as you can tell everybody that watches the movie, this is not Tom Hanks. You are not watching a Tom Hanks movie.
Right.
Watch it at your own risk, right? And if you're Tom Hanks, you've got a legal battle to fight so that you get some kind of royalties from this project or whatever. But I don't know.
Yeah, it's the same with music, right? I'm a big music buff. You know, I saw something else about Taylor Swift and music. I guess there's a way to take her entire catalog of music, somehow use technology that figures out what makes her music connect, write another chord structure similar, use her voice. But it's not like anyone can profit from that.
No.
That would just be fun, people having fun on the internet doing that.
And really, what I understand about the music industry is musicians anymore release records so that they can tour.
Yes, that's right.
Most of their money is made touring. And so we're not talking about an AI that puts a robot Taylor Swift on stage and makes money producing a fake Taylor. Taylor Swift shows are still going to be Taylor Swift. And she's probably going to use AI because I know how much she's into technology and putting on a great show. She'll probably look at, how do I do this? How do I put four or five Taylor Swifts on stage talking to each other? Like, and the fans would love it. So there's opportunities to use this stuff and use that same technology in a way that benefits the artist. And it, you know, it's, again, it's not, the technology itself is not bad. It's the application of that technology that can be negative.
And where you don't want to be hoodwinked by it. The great Swedish group ABBA, that's yeah. getting into my...
Sure, but sure, sure.
You, have you seen what they're doing? They've got these concerts that have these images on stage, and they're selling out venues across Europe and in the U.S. But you know it going in. It's yeah. not the real characters. The real players gave their permission. They've copyrighted. Mm-hmm. They're getting paid. But you know, oh, I'm seeing these almost Star Trek-like characters in their thing, and I'm loving it. So I think that gets back to, as long as I know it,
mm-hmm.
going
in
and I'm comfortable with it, I'll still play my ABBA records over here mm-hmm. and I'll go see this show. And it's the same with Taylor Swift. I think what we're really talking about here on this as we wrap it up, Brandon, is the fact that this is real. It's here. Mm-hmm. It's not going away. We can't start to think about, well, we've got to put a cap on it. It's all the cliches that toothpaste is out of the tube,
right.
you know, the yeah. tube and all that stuff. But we do have personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. We have to do our own homework. We have to be intentional. We have to look at the good things. Anything else that you would add?
And as an industry, we have to be aware of the pitfalls, and we need to engineer our way around them. It's not enough to say, it's not my fault. I didn't develop it. No, it is. You applied it. You used it. So as an industry, we need to be aware of the dangers and then make sure we engineer protections around all of those.
Brandon Fisher of 1904 Labs here in St. Louis. I will say, and I mean this sincerely, I've learned a ton, and I actually feel a little bit more comfortable. I'm Good. Not saying that I still Good. Don't have concerns, but I like how you've really articulated this. I think there's a lot more exciting opportunities than scary, but it's really going to come back to us as individuals. Brandon, thank you very much.
Awesome. This was great. So you're very welcome. And I'd be happy to come on anytime you need to talk about AI.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening. And please forward the link to this podcast to friends, family, neighbors, even strangers. They'll thank you later. If you'd like more information on our wealth management team, just go to your search engine and type in Simons and Cordes, S-I-M-O-N-S and C-O-R-D-E-S, Simons and Cordes, and the website will be the first thing that pops up. I'll talk to you again soon on the next episode of the Simon Says podcast.